Jern Bain Bain, how to create a successful urban district. Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski and welcome to the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities and many more. I have been working at the intersection of people, place and technology for over 20 years, combining my passions for storytelling and urbanism to create a more equitable and sustainable society. The author of the words and my today's guest is Jesse Chapins, who is the head of urban strategy and design at NREP and Urban Partners, Europe's leading sustainable urban investor and developer. Jesse focuses on putting into practice new models of urbanism that align people, cities, and capital. Let us talk about big and long-term urban developments, the ones that are in the intersection of people, place, and technology, as my guest says. We will use the new Copenhagen redevelopment project, Jern Bain Bain, as an example of fostering an ambitious urbanism vision. Jern Bain Bain is actually the largest regeneration project in Copenhagen, most likely in Denmark as well. And today we will discuss how Jesse is applying his experience that he gained from all different cities in the world. He was working a lot with art and urban participation, as well as community building, which is a very important aspect of the project, which in this case is realized through a community hub called SPO-T or Track 10, which serves as this community hub for people that are now or will be in the future part of the project and the whole development. One last interesting element is that Jesse was senior director of urban development at Sidewalk Labs, pretty famous project that was being developed in the waterfront of Toronto, but eventually was not realized. We also talk about some lessons from there. To hear more about how to apply those experiences that Jesse has into the big regeneration project in Copenhagen, welcome to the newest episode. Let me just start and say that I'm happy to have you here, Jesse. Thanks for joining.
Very happy to be here with you.
I was wondering, you are quite new to Copenhagen, not very new, but still. And for some people that are not familiar with your work here, I was wondering if it would be a good idea to start with a short introduction from your side. I would like to discuss today the intersection of urbanism with technology, but also with this kind of social approach to urban projects. And I think that you are the person that is carrying a lot of knowledge around those topics. And I would like to pick your brain and share with the listeners of the podcast some interesting approaches to big complex urban developments. But before that, what would be the best way to start? you wear so many hats.
Well, I'm happy to give you a little quick background on myself and sort of how I ended up here sitting in Vestibule on a rainy Thursday morning. But I was born in the United States. I was actually born in Colorado. And both of my parents actually were landscape architects, urban designers. Mm. They studied with Ian McCarg, who some of you might know, sort of significant figure in sort of a lot of the early thinking around sort of environmental studies, data, and sort of regional planning and how to actually take a holistic view to kind of regional design. And so I grew up, they ran a studio in the small town where I lived, Boulder, Colorado. And so I got to see sort of firsthand their work and the role that sort of, let's say, kind of design professions, but more broadly, all the stakeholders that were involved in sort of shaping place. Mm-hmm. And I think it really stuck with me, just this understanding that, you know, place is not something that just happens by accident. Mm. There's sort of a whole range of people that are involved in making decisions, intentional, unintentional, that really fundamentally shape who we are in our society and that place is, in fact, sort of the bedrock of society. So that was sort of my childhood, and just fell in love then with larger cities and the role that cities play more broadly in the world and sort of culture and politics and economy. Moved to New York City, studied urban studies there. And in that process, actually traveled a little bit to Europe and fell in love with Berlin, as many people have and people in the kind of urban fields do. This was sort of in the late 90s, early aughts, and sort of just seeing a city that, you know, clearly has been sort of the epicenter of so much modern transformation, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of worst and most kind of glorious sides, you could say, of sort of European history. And as somebody also with a Jewish background, actually, to kind of experience that sort of place and sort of the kind of intensity of that history, but also the sort of ways in which that history is being grappled with within the city itself. And so ended up doing my kind of undergraduate research about the Mauer Park, a park that was built on the former stretch of the wall separating Berlin, Mitte, Prenzlauer Berg, and Wedding, and really looking at the role of sort of landscape design as it relates to memory, as it relates to kind of social life, and relates to kind of broader kind of urban transformation. And then my kind of career just continued to evolve from there around sort of broadly these topics of sort of how do you bring together as many perspectives as possible into how to make better places for people. Mm-hmm. And involved, you know, going back to New York, actually starting a documentary arts nonprofit in Brooklyn that continues to exist today called Union Docs, working with the local community, working with sort of media as a means of sort of understanding history and also imagining the future. Mm-hmm. But also getting more involved entrepreneurially in technology and an early kind of technology media project about sort of cities called Yellow Arrow. You have to imagine this was in 2004, mm-hmm. before kind of the invention of smartphones. You have to kind of truly remember that there was a period of time where we didn't carry these things with us all the time. That all the capabilities that is something like an iPhone has today didn't exist. And in fact, the most breaking, like cutting edge technology was text messaging. So the idea that you could actually use a phone for something that was beyond just making a call, but actually send messages and information. And the kind of insight that my collaborators and I had was sort of how could we start to use that technology as a way to actually enhance people's connection to place. And so the project was built around actually physical stickers, sort of a little bit of inspiration from sort of street art and kind of the graffiti kind of culture of the time, and stickers that each then had a unique code on them. And a telephone number, and people could actually order the stickers. We kind of packaged them up, sent it to them by mail. And then they'd go around the city placing those stickers, pointing out places that there was sort of a little message they would like to leave. And sort of some ways injecting, kind of bringing to life, let's say, the invisible aspects of the city into the physical space itself. And so you could send a text message with that code that was on the sticker to the number. And then whatever little short message you wanted to say about that place. And that meant that whenever somebody else saw that sticker, they could send the code to the number and get that original message back. And then that person could also reply anonymously to kind of start a conversation about that location.
And if some people liked each other, it was almost like a first dating app.
Yeah. A first dating app around place. So place was sort of the anchor and sort of the social connections and stories around place. And you know, you could have things about sort of bringing to life the history of a place. There was actually also at that time, even in Copenhagen here, was one of the places that was actually most popular. And it was used already in sort of early urban development discussions about the transformation of the South Harbor. Mm. Even sort of Politiken here kind of saw it as an interesting sort of way to kind of extend media conversation about the city and distributed arrows to all of their subscribers. And even I think a mayoral election at the time, the candidates actually placed arrows saying sort of, these are places and sort of messages that I'd like to kind of share and invite conversation around. So that was sort of an important early experience around sort of this intersection of technology and place. And I think the thing that I think was really important in that work, and I think has held through my career, is that the technology was only ever sort of an interesting enabler for how you bring people closer to their physical world. And the embodied experience, the social connections, and technology, I think, has an important and exciting role to play in that. But I think we've also seen that it can do many other things that draw people further away from each other, further away from place. And my work has largely been focused on sort of the other side of the coin. Mm.
How did that shift over the years from being something that connects us to something that divides us? Because I also see a threat of this digital exclusion. We often talk about digital poles or different solutions like mirror boards and so on, where people can collaborate or share their voice. But there are many people, especially older people, that are not that proficient in navigating with those technological advices. What's your take on that?
I think when I also think about technology, I don't purely think of it as digital. Okay. I think technology is sort of an extension of ourselves and in kind of means of sort of tools, let's say, for sort of making sense of and interacting with the world. And so in other words, I would actually describe, let's say, an in-person public meeting that involves a presentation and a discussion and a, you know, pen and paper and sticky notes also as a form of technology.
Okay.
And I guess what I think we should also ask ourselves is who's included and excluded from every use of technology. Of course, I think it somehow becomes easier for us to see that digital technologies obviously can create some level of exclusion. There's people that feel less comfortable, older people, for example, some younger people potentially, different sort of demographics, different sort of resources and means. But also our other forms of technology for inviting participation in cities have also been extraordinarily exclusive as well. There's certain people that show up for public meetings. Mm. There's certain kind of languages and cultures that you need to feel comfortable with to participate in a discussion in a municipality around the future of a neighborhood. And we know that there's a certain population of people that show up for that as well. Mm. So I guess I would encourage us to think about a range of technologies to try to reach the widest population as possible, knowing that no technology ever will be completely inclusive. And inherently, it's our job to sort of just be aware of that and try to build a kind of democratic and diverse a population as possible in these processes.
I think it's a good segue to the project that you are currently developing, and as well, just to put it in some physical context, let's talk about the big development that is happening now in Copenhagen. And I guess that you are part of many discussions, and you as well, I guess, get a lot of questions about the development, about the direction of that development. We are discussing the Jernbanen, which is the rail yard district in the central of Copenhagen, which is being transformed. It's a huge, huge development. How do you bring your experience, your perspectives of connecting the technology with the urban world, with the urban development into that project? And I hope we can discuss it a bit more, because from what I know, it has so many layers already.
Yeah. So just to give a little bit more context then of sort of my work today.
Definitely.
So I moved to Copenhagen a little over a year ago to join a company that is now called Urban Partners. And we work sort of across sort of all different aspects of sort of what you could say is sort of the urban value chain, all the different actors and sort of systems to make better cities, to make more sustainable cities. And NREP is a kind of real estate development arm that was sort of the origins of the company and has been sort of the lead in sort of partnering with the state real estate company and the state railway company in the transformation of the central Copenhagen area, the railway district. And I came over here from the United States, sort of having worked, you know, as I was describing, sort of on these topics of sort of urban transformation for now many years, and just getting more and more sort of inspired and in a way also curious about how sort of you could try to work at a truly holistic scale and look at the whole range of sort of opportunities that when you're planning a kind of large area you have, and try to bring together actually and align the kind of goals and incentives of investors, developers, residents, and municipalities. Mm. Not the easiest task. But in that sort of inspiration came across this company, Urban Partners, and just felt that there was nobody else that I'd seen in the world actually taking as much of a kind of progressive approach to this, having already been quite involved in sort of really interesting sort of impactful regeneration projects in Copenhagen, and being involved in this railway district project here. And so I moved to join and sort of lead our kind of urban development work, both here in Copenhagen, but also more broadly internationally. And so this project, I think, when you ask the question of sort of how do I then bring my experience, both the technology, but more broadly, I think the thing that as a process I like to always start with is sort of as a collective, what are we trying to achieve? I think every neighborhood transformation project, any urban development project of any scale is both a kind of challenge and an opportunity to kind of move society forward. And actually brings together, you know, again, many resources from sort of the private side, the public side, and to the citizen side. And I think the best way to sort of maximize the value for all of those stakeholders is to try to get everybody aligned around a common vision. Mm. And I think this project, fortunately, there'd been already decade plus of work in the city, the state real estate company, the state railway company, working with the municipality, going through kind of designating this old railway area that is no longer used for its freight rail purposes to become transformed into a kind of green mixed use neighborhood. And that was designated in the municipal plan of 2019. And then they went out actually and did a competition with a really clear set of constraints so that it was sort of a feasible kind of implementation. And COBA, a local planning design landscape urbanism firm, won that competition with, I think, a really strong master plan. And all of that work, I think, was really grounded in what we've now come to kind of see as sort of a place that is sort of looking at how do you actually take a central neighborhood area like this that, you know, has its sort of interesting qualities as being a place with very, you know, it's almost a sort of a hidden gem, sort of secret space in the middle of the city.
Not everyone is aware of.
You have to picture sort of, you know, it's an area that is just, you know, a 5-minute bike ride from the central train station, directly close to the central harbor and other central neighborhoods, but sort of by the means of sort of the rail lines, as well as a highway, has been sort of cut off from people's kind of access and consciousness, I would say. And this is also where I think it's really important when we talk about place, we tend to focus on sort of just the physical qualities, but also the psychological qualities have a huge influence. And this is a place that psychologically you could say has been off the map for most Copenhageners. And so I think this project is largely about acknowledging that this space exists in the center of the city. Its old uses as a freight rail yard are no longer relevant. How can we actually redevelop this into something that actually benefits the city today and serves the needs of the city today? And so the common vision was to say, we know that there's a need for more kind of housing in the central city. We know that there's a need to make that housing a diversity of sort of access points, from sort of social housing through actually even down to kind of supportive housing for homelessness, up through kind of ownership housing and rental housing, intergenerational housing. So really, how do you actually build a kind of place that has a whole range of housing options that is then linked to a truly kind of vibrant community that creates a sense of kind of belonging for all the different people that are there? And so mixing that with offices, mixing that with workshops, mixing that with social infrastructure, public space, and doing it in a way that really moves forward the green agenda. So actually, in that case, making a place that you don't have to rely on cars, so that we can actually really show that it's possible to reduce our emissions from the transport sector, but also, of course, from the sort of building kind of side in terms of the kind of energy, heating, cooling systems and the kind of materials of the buildings themselves. So put together, we sort of see it as a place, and this is, again, not just me speaking, this is sort of the, I think, the work of this decade plus kind of unified approach of these different stakeholders to say, how do we make one of the most lively mixed districts in the center of the city? And do that as sort of a way that really is green and healthy, and looking at how do you make health for people and planet through urban design and development.
But as said before, it's a long process. Yeah. It's already 10 years on the go, and then we are looking into another decades of the development of the project. But you somehow need to kickstart and put the place on the map, right? Yeah. On the mental map of the citizens, tourists, and not only. There are many different temporary uses in projects like this. And there is one particular building in the project that I thought it's a temporary use, but you corrected me that it's not. Mm-hmm. And here I would like to discuss how can you develop a project based on this kind of approach to an old building and make it into a new community center, and not into a temporary one, but with a longer version. So just to share the name, I would like to ask you about the idea around the Spore T.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is most important in these long-term projects is that you have to always work on two timescales at once. Mm. You have to both really work on sort of what's the long-term future that we all are aspiring towards, and what are the kind of key outcomes that hold us together. Again, we know that we want this to be a place that promotes social cohesion and gives opportunity for a range of people in terms of housing and economy. We know there's things on decarbonization, biodiversity. But those are obviously the things that bind the long-term thinking. And you also have to bring to life and actually test and learn and build with people already at the very beginning. And I think that's always been my approach, is to sort of see these two timescales in concert. And so Spore 10, or Spore T, to the best of my Danish pronunciation, is sort of the anchor of this approach. And so the master plan for the neighborhood, in the first area of development, there's one existing historic building, a rail customs house built in the 1960s. And already in the master plan that the COBA produced, that building was sort of envisioned as being transformed into the central community hub public space for the neighborhood. And when I sort of began working on the project and talking to people and learning about sort of the aspirations that were shared for this place, it occurred to me that this is an incredible opportunity to kind of work in a way that is a little different than your traditional development projects. Your traditional development projects, you could say, typically, if you're sort of aiming for a kind of more short-term kind of optimization, you will say, let's actually build the things that generate the most cash flow as quickly as possible that allow for us to kind of then sell those properties as quickly as possible and get out. That's like the worst of kind of short-term urban development thinking. And it ends up meaning that sort of community infrastructure, all the kind of social sides of places, a lot of the public aspects of spaces and streets and such and parks are sort of left behind. To the best of the degree, a municipality fills in those gaps, but increasingly even the most sort of well-resourced municipalities find challenges in delivering that. Here, we've been basically flipping that model on its head and saying, let's actually start with this kind of community hub as actually the anchor. We know it will be the community hub in the long term. The space will be transformed into that space. It will be sort of established as a kind of independent nonprofit organization that carries forward and holds that mission and purpose in perpetuity. And rather than wait until the very end to create that, let's actually do it now. So the space today is already occupied by a whole range of different community actors that all have a common sort of shared purpose around how do you promote health holistically for people of different ages and backgrounds through kind of social connection, physical activity, and healthy food. And so you have on the kind of a really interesting group of kind of associations working with sort of rollerblading and skating and scooting activities that sort of bring together young people, also a lot of people with neurodiversity, and they actually built their own sort of like skate hall within the building itself, supported by the municipality in this case. You have groups focusing on sort of food systems. There's an exhibition around sort of foodscapes that was put together by Gale and Novo Nordisk, helping to kind of understand the role of the built environment in food. But then actually Noon, which is a really interesting sort of healthy food provider based already in Jan Benebuen, doing communal dinners on Wednesday nights for people. You have NGOs like Cycling Without Age that sort of has invented these really cool bicycles that basically make it easy for young people and old people to ride together around the city in a kind of program of volunteers to do those rides together. They're based in the space and they're kind of running kind of their programs out of it. I could keep going and going. There's actually dozens of groups now. We have hundreds of people coming every Wednesday to be part of this. And I think it's already showing that there's something different in this approach and actually intentionally building community and intentionally building a place again that fosters, I would say, belonging, an invitation to belong for a wide range of backgrounds. So this is a place that people that are living in social housing already in the surrounding areas are invited and welcome. These are people that live in Vestibule that might, you know, have more means. These are people living on Suhaon and some of the newer developments there. People from across the city, very intentionally sort of seeing this as a place that all those people are invited and welcome and starting to build a sense of strong connection. Because I think it is, as you were indicating, you know, this is a space in the city today that has a few residents that live there today. And often the question is asked sort of, how do you build a new neighborhood where there is no existing community? And I think one of the things when we use the word community is we often think of it as first and foremost only the people that live in a place. But neighborhoods are always, the best neighborhoods are a mix of places for the people that live there, the places for the people that work there, and the places for people that visit, the residents of the broader city that also see those neighborhoods as resources for their needs and connections. And we're very intentionally building for all three of those layers from the outset.
Is that specific to the Danish context? And here I would like to compare this development with some of the previous ones that you've been part of. So for example, the sidewalks slabs in Toronto, a big master plan, which at the end, it was not successful. It was not developed. And here in Denmark, when you say about this concept of the community first approach, how do you think it will develop? Is there something special in the Danish or maybe the Copenhagen approach and community, maybe the democratic approach that gives this project a chance to be actually developed?
Yeah. I think the thing that's really strong in Denmark that I hope we can actually try to grow in other parts of the world and in cities like Toronto and other cities across Europe and North America is trust. I think the thing that is in part makes this work in Copenhagen possible is that there is a level of trust shared across the different actors that I just described, the stakeholders. So there's a level of trust the municipality has that we as a private investor and developer actually are, while not the same, trying to actually do things that contribute to a broader kind of long-term benefit of the city. I think there's a trust from the residents that the city is working in their interest to try to make a place that is beneficial for a wide range of the Copenhagen population. And then there's a trust then amongst the different sort of segments of society to a degree, the residents that sort of we're in this together and that we want to make a greater, better Copenhagen long-term for people of all ages and backgrounds. Of course, those are not all the same. Of course, people acknowledge that there's differences and there is debate, but there's a greater sense of trust amongst those different stakeholders here in Copenhagen than I've found in other cities. And I think what that allows is, in fact, then these more sort of what I would say kind of creative and kind of hybrid models that allow for people to work more closely with each other and to test and learn and experiment more easily around how we make better places. I think one of the challenges that certainly I faced and others working in this sphere, not just sort of sidewalk labs, but a city like Toronto, unfortunately, has quite a high degree of kind of distrust and animosity between, let's say, the private investment community, the development community, the municipality, and its residents. There's a history of maybe the municipality not always sort of acting truly on the behalf of the residents, not actually following through on its commitments to deliver meaningful public infrastructure, transit. That new development hasn't always been seen as being sort of thought of on the behalf of the wide ranges of needs of the people of the city. And that's, of course, not unique to Toronto. You find that in a lot of cities. And I think that Sidewalk Labs and the work that we were doing there kind of was obviously part of that broader context. And we probably, you know, it was a project of a very high profile involving a kind of international company affiliated with Google, taking place in the middle of sort of a broader kind of, I think, productive kind of cultural and societal awakening to the sort of more negative impacts that technology can have on society. Cambridge Analytica and others just made it such a polarizing project that it became very difficult to truly work in a trust-based kind of multi-stakeholder model. I think what's unique about Denmark is that level of trust, but I don't think we should then assume we can't build greater trust across stakeholder groups in other parts of the world. I think we will be kind of giving up too early and too easily if we just say, oh, that's special for Denmark and, you know, other places this is impossible.
Very interesting to hear your perspective as someone who is kind of still new to Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, it's only been a year or so. I was interested in the processes that you observe while you come and you start collaborating with all those different actors, with the municipality, with architects as well, with the community. And for you as someone who is working for the developer, for urban developer, for NREP Urban Partners, developing this project, of course, there is, I assume, a longer benefit, a financial benefit that the company wants to achieve. And here I would like to ask you, how can we measure those? So what kind of measurements for achieving these financial targets can be used or do you use? But also, how can you integrate those in this more sustainable visions that you've presented?
You know, we are a private commercial investment and development company. And I wouldn't say that our financial criteria for success are markedly different than other actors. Like, we measure success in terms of, you know, IRR, multiples of capital, you know, the kind of overall fundamental kind of economic performance, you could say, of the investments and developments that we are a part of. I think what's different is that we allow for a time horizon to be much longer. And what that means is that it allows for you to actually work with a different model, I would say, of long-term value creation and acknowledge that, in fact, long-term, the best, most valuable, lowest risk areas are places that have high social cohesion, that have assets, you could call them, you know, in this language of sort of buildings and infrastructure that are much more sort of climate resilient, and that are places that people want to be and spend time with each other, and that are attractive and vibrant and also have a mix of uses, so that also as needs and things of the market and community fluctuates, it is resilient to those changes. So if you have that long-term perspective, and if you really foreground that sort of also long-term risk mitigation, it allows you to say, in fact, things like ensuring that there's an adequate and high level of green and public space is a long-term value driver or sort of risk mitigant. It allows you to say that if we don't have sufficient social infrastructure in this place, if there's not sufficient also municipal functions, if there's not sufficient social housing, this is a place that runs the risk of actually not being socially attractive, socially cohesive, and the type of place that will sort of withstand kind of shocks over time. So I think it's that long-term perspective that allows us to then see that these things that might not conceivably be understood as sort of on their own terms financially rewarding be worthwhile in terms of investment, and investment especially in the early stage. A lot of these things are things that you end up having to commit to and having to invest in already what you could say is the pre-development. So in your master planning and zoning phase, not even before you get into the construction side. So then to say it's our metrics for financial success are probably similar. They have that longer time horizon, allows us to do things differently than your traditional investor and developer. And we also couple those financial metrics with non-financial metrics. So, you know, the most kind of established within our business is certainly the kind of decarbonization. Beyond just sort of our work in Copenhagen, we've been at the forefront of sort of making a pledge that our entire portfolio is sort of decarbonized and kind of net zero by 2028 and aligning our work with the science-based targets of the Paris Agreement. And so that means that everything that we do in this project, of course, has to meet those goals and actually go beyond them also in terms of looking at other ways to drive decarbonization and measure that decarbonization from also, let's say, the transport sector, as I mentioned. So if you actually have less reliance on cars, you have the promotion of more biking and walking and public transit, inherently you will have fewer emissions and you will also have higher quality of life. We're also looking, though I wouldn't say we've nailed the exact metrics to do this, but to understand that this approach really can also be understood as, you could say, almost preventative public health. So how do you actually work with the idea that public health, the key kind of environmental and social determinants of health for a population are often the level of social connection, the degree of loneliness or not that a population experiences, which goes across ages. It's not at all just sort of a phenomenon of elderly people. There's rising and challenging issues of loneliness amongst younger people. And so if you are able to promote more social connection amongst people, that is actually a key driver for mitigating actual long-term health risks. Having more physical activity, of course, is well understood, walking, biking, more recreational opportunities, but also that topic of sort of more access to healthy, sustainable, affordable food. And all those things, you know, the probably the most kind of classic metric for that is sort of life expectancy. It's probably a little ambitious to kind of build a project around that as the primary metric because, you know, that's like, we have whole lifetimes then to measure to determine whether we've been successful. But actually understanding that there's plenty of science and evidence that knows that if these certain things are true, in terms of your planning design, the kind of invitations to certain behavior, that if you use those as a proxy, you can sort of have confidence that you are sort of promoting a healthier kind of population than you would otherwise.
I would like to wrap it up with inspirational note. So first of all, I would love to add some more information in the episode description about the project. So feel free to share some materials with me after and I'll just share it with the listeners so they can learn a bit more. And also there's one more thing. Would you be able to recommend a book around the topic? Something that maybe inspired you and influenced your work?
It's a great question. So in some ways, I guess I would say one of the most influential works for me from very early on was actually a very kind of almost 100-year-old text by Georg Simmel called The Metropolis and Mental Life. So it was a text that was written sort of at the, you know, turn of the 20th century in the context of the city of Berlin and sort of very much acknowledging that the city is a place that produces a different psychology and that psychology ends up shaping behavior. And that's to say that there's sort of this way of working in a city that is not only just physical, but it is also the non-physical, it is the social, it is the psychological, and that the opportunity to really shape places is driven by how you work in those things together. I also, more recently, you know, as I got more and more kind of involved in urban development, you know, read Kate Raworth's book, Donut Economics, which I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with, but I think it does offer a really powerful framework for actually understanding planetary boundaries, so social foundations, and how do you try to kind of build towards a society or towards cities that sort of sit between those two. And I think it's an important model, and it's a little different than you could say things like degrowth that sort of start, I would say, from a kind of negative perspective. The donut, I think, is sort of acknowledging that we are currently on a pathway to exceed our planetary boundaries, and we are not operating within our social foundation, but we should acknowledge that we are moving and growing and we should try to steer the direction of our societies towards moving inside that circle. And I guess just the last thing, I haven't finished reading it, but I found it quite interesting. It just came out of the United States. It's a book called Fragile Neighborhoods by an author, Seth Kaplan, somebody actually that worked around kind of fragile states internationally and looking at sort of the role of neighborhoods in sort of being foundational to, you know, people's kind of health, well-being, kind of societal well-being, especially in the US context. And there's, you know, more dramatic challenges there than I think we probably face here in Denmark. But I think a really interesting text that I'm currently reading and finding a lot of interesting inspiration from.
That's been a really a developed recommendation. Three different ones. But thanks very much. I tend to often buy the books that are recommended by my guests. And you're right, that Donut Economics is something that I've already read. But Seth Kaplan's book was something on the radar as well. So thanks for that. And overall, Jesse, I would like to say big thanks for joining our podcast and sharing with us some perspectives on those complex urban developments, long-term urban developments. And personally, I need to say that as someone who lives in Copenhagen and plans to live in Copenhagen, I'm really looking forward to see the project growing and being developed.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening, and I hope that the newest conversation with Jesse was interesting to you. If you would like to get to know anything more about the project, about Ian Bain-Bean, you can visit NREP's website and see the project there. I added the link in the episode's description. Thank you for being here with us, and talk to you soon.